Hello, welcome to Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas, where, with the help of the world's leading experts, we examine the most important questions of our time. I'm Adam Bolton, and in this episode, we'll explore the ever-expanding world of artificial intelligence, or AI as it's known. AI can mimic language, generate art, and diagnose serious illnesses. But can it think, speak, and feel in the way that a human does? Are contributors, authorities in the fields of psychology, computer science, philosophy, culture, and history give their answers? Later in this episode, I'm joined by Hugo Rifkind and Gabby Wood to discuss the impact on publishing and journalism. First, to find out what the arrival of AI really means, I spoke to Gary Marcus and Ernest Davis, professors at New York University, co-authors of Rebooting AI, Building Artificial Intelligence We Can Trust, which is published by Knopf Doubleday. First, Gary Marcus, Emeritus Professor of Psychology and Neural Science. So just how big is AI?
I think it's changing our world. I don't think it's anything like what a lot of people are perceiving it to be. It's not nearly as intelligent as people think, but it's certainly changing our world. I don't think anybody really appreciates yet what's happening as a function of these new technologies that are being rolled out.
And how is it changing our world? I mean, what are the most obvious applications?
Well, probably the best application so far is helping people program computers by writing code for them. It's not perfect, but programmers know how to debug things, and so they can use it. Maybe the worst application is I think bad actors are going to use it to create misinformation at scale like we've never seen before. And so people are probably going to lose trust in a lot of things. And I think it's going to have a negative consequence for democracy. So there's everything kind of in between those extremes, from really helping with the business of computer programming to really harming the information ecosphere.
And you say bad actors could misuse it. I mean, that is because ultimately it can't tell right from wrong or fact from fiction.
Well, that's exactly right. The systems themselves can't tell right from wrong nor fact from fiction. They hallucinate a lot, and they can also be quickly retrained to produce propaganda of any variety that you might like in very plausible ways that are going to be hard for human beings to detect. And because they have no conscience or ethics or anything like that, the machines are perfectly happy to do whatever it is that you instruct them to do.
Would it be possible to, as it were, build in a truth button or a sort of decency button into the coding?
Not in the way it's currently built. So the way it's currently built, it's basically like autocomplete on steroids. So it really just knows how to predict what words might be plausible in a particular context. But there's nothing in the system that recognizes truth. It doesn't inherently have a way to do fact checking. You could build other systems on top of it, just like you could have a writer and then someone at, you know, the New Yorker or something like that checks facts around them, a separate entity. So you could have a separate entity to do this. And in fact, I'm interested in building a commercial enterprise to try to do that. But the current technology is not really up to the job.
And would you agree with those who just say this is going to be a mass unemployer, that loads of people are going to lose their jobs?
I mean, maybe in the long term, you know, 100 years from now, I don't think there will be many people working for a living. In the short term, most of these systems are not really that smart. And so they can typically do some part of somebody's job, but they can't usually do an entire job well. So there's definitely going to be some disruption. And I think that people who draw commercial art, the sort of workaday people, I think are definitely threatened, because you can now generate art that borrows heavily from human work but looks pretty good very efficiently. And so I think that kind of commercial artist is probably threatened in the short term. I don't think computer programmers are really that threatened, because the machines can only do a small part of what their job is. And so they'll still have plenty of work to do. And it's going to be kind of case by case.
Professor, as you know, Bill Gates argues that AI is a force for good, particularly in the medical and scientific research area. Do you agree?
I think there's huge potential there, but that AI hasn't entirely lived up to that potential yet, for a bunch of reasons. So I don't think AI is sophisticated enough yet to actually understand the medical literature. I think the biggest contribution is probably from DeepMind with their protein folding database, which is certainly useful. But if you think about things like IBM Watson kind of doing oncology from medical records, it's still not really practical, partly because the medical records themselves have a lot of problems. They're kind of, at least in the United States, built around billing rather than scientific questions. There's a lot of things in what we call unstructured text that machines aren't very good at reading. Until machines can really read with comprehension, I don't think they're going to fulfill the enormous potential that they have for medicine. Someday they will, and I think that's one of the reasons why we should keep working on AI. But right now, the systems that we're using, they can do kind of like party games, like pass medical licensing exams, but that doesn't mean that they actually make good doctors. I think we're actually pretty far from that.
Do you think, I mean, you mentioned being able there to basically evaluate what you're seeing. Will machines ever be able to do that? I mean, will they ever be conscious, or is there something about life, carbon-based life, if you like, that cannot be reproduced mechanically?
I don't know that we want them to be conscious. I'm self-reflective. I'm not sure we want them to reflect on why, you know, we make them do all this work and don't pay them and so forth. In terms of them being able to do intellectual feats like reasoning or reading, I think there's every reason to be optimistic in the long term, not the short term.
Optimistic that they will be able to do it or that they won't be able to do it?
That they will be able to, for example, read the medical literature and come up with ideas for how to treat things like Alzheimer's where we've really struggled. I'm pretty optimistic that machines are going to help there. You don't need to be conscious to do that, whatever that even means. You just need to be able to translate words into ideas. And I see no conceptual reason why a physical machine shouldn't be able to do this. I mean, we're just physical machines, just made of carbon rather than silicon.
Are we a bit more than that? That's a sort of big religious question, isn't it?
Well, I mean, in my view, we are biological machines, and I really don't see the argument otherwise. I realize that some people do see it otherwise, but in my worldview, we're just biological machines, and we're trying to figure out the details, and we figured out a lot, you know, enough to, I think, be confident that we are biological machines. But it's at the same time, there's enormous complexity there that we haven't figured out, and we haven't figured out how to replicate.
We also have consciousness, don't we, which is...
We presumably do, but what I'm saying is that whatever that is may not be necessary. What I think machines do need to have is an awareness of how the world works and how the words that they use relate to the world, and that is absent in current systems, current popular systems. But for example, we have GPS systems that know a little bit about the world. They know where they are now and where you want to go, and they plot a course to tell you how to get there. And they do that perfectly well. They don't need to be conscious, but they have to have an awareness of their location in space.
I mean, it's been suggested, for example, in the area of autonomous vehicles, that AI really could make the difference because of the amount of information it would be able to digest. Would you agree?
Well, autonomous vehicles have been a bit of an embarrassment, right? People have been working on them for 30 years. Our computers are tens of times of thousands faster. We have vastly more data, and they still don't work all that well. They kind of sort of work in demonstrations. If you limit them to driving in some particular place at some particular hour, but, you know, even the best ones that we have right now are not going to be able to drive where there's complex interacting patterns of human pedestrians and bad weather and stuff like that. And so, like, I think that too is a solvable problem, but I'm not sure it's solvable with the technology that we have right now. It hasn't become conceptually deep enough for these machines to understand unexpected circumstances in the world. So I think we really need to rethink how we're doing that. We will, but it may take some time.
Do you think there's any chance of, you know, what some people call the singularity? Science fiction writers have discussed it, the kind of machines becoming smarter than us and basically taking over?
I think it could happen. I think it's a bit oversimplified in the sense that intelligence is a multidimensional thing. There are some pieces of it that machines are good at and some that are bad. But, you know, if you look 100 years from now, I don't think anybody can really project out exactly where we'll be or what the motivations of the machines will be or whether we will have understood enough about how to control them. You know, I think there's enough to worry about in the short term that I don't worry a lot about the 100-year horizon where nobody can really make good predictions anyway. I worry mostly in the short term horizon about misinformation, medical misinformation, bias, things like that, drones and what they might be used for. You know, there are a lot of short term risks, and I think our minds should mainly be there right now.
Okay, now coming to an end, but how should lawmakers, legislators approach AI? What do you think they need to be doing?
First thing legislators need to do is to actually understand AI. They should read books like My Rebooting AI in order to get the point that there is both narrow AI and general AI, and that the current AI that we have is not very sophisticated. Like, if you don't understand that and you take AI to simply be some kind of magic, then you don't really understand what the issues are. And I'm afraid that most legislators don't. They're not really equipped to think about it. They don't really have any education. So that's number one, is legislators are going to have to put in some work into it. Just like we need mathematical literacy, we need a kind of AI literacy if we have any hope. Step two is we really need to worry about the misinformation problem. And I think we need to penalize large-scale purveying of misinformation. And ultimately, the government needs to have the authority to shut things down if there's enough concern about them, or at least pause them for some period of time.
That was Gary Marcus. Now, his colleague at New York University and co-author, Ernest Davis, joins us. He's professor of computer science. So what is different about AI from what we already know of computers and digital technology?
It's quite different. It carries out tasks that we have not been able to do previously with computer technology. So systems like GPT and ChatGPT are able to answer questions with very fluent and often correct looking texts, which, you know, previous AIs were not able to do. Vision technology has been improving steadily over the years. We now have systems like DALL-E, which can generate pictures from a caption. There's a lot that this technology can do that didn't exist even a year ago.
No, I understand, but is it really sort of super aggregation, kind of super Google in a sense? I suppose what I'm really asking is whether it's creative, ultimately.
Whether it's creative? That's a very fraught word. I don't... it appears creative, certainly in some instances.
But that, to me, is the essence of intelligence, that we feel that we are moving forward, we're making progress, we're creating new things of value. But it seems to me, from the outside, that what AI is doing is basically riffing on the available information created by humans.
I mean, that's true to a large extent. I mean, there are certainly limits to the useful originality that AIs have displayed so far. And mostly, they are echoing things that, more or less echoing things that they've seen, which were created by humans. But new combinations of old things can be new. And where you draw the line, where you start to enter into true creativity, is not a sharp line by any means.
You've mentioned chat and DALL-E. I mean, where are we seeing it now in terms of practical applications?
That's a good question. The practical applications have been so far limited of this very new technology. The main practical application that I've seen is in writing programmers. So one gets reliable reports that people who are doing serious programming find these tools useful in day-to-day coding. So I had one expert programmer who said that at this point, 80% of the code that he gets out of the system is correct, and 80% of the code that he writes was in fact generated by the system. So that's a practical use. It's saving them a certain amount of time. I think there is probably some practical use for the image generator, because that's a difficult thing for people to do. And if you just want a quick picture to illustrate a point, well, then you can often get it out quickly from systems like DALL-E. I've used it once or twice myself.
It'll be useful for slide packs.
For slide packs, yeah. You wouldn't hire it as a political cartoonist, but yeah, just for producing a quick illustration that's, you know, usable and visible and vivid. It can be used that way. I am just in the last couple of weeks being released a new search engine which was integrated with ChatGPT, but that's, as you know, run into some serious bumps. And I wouldn't say that that's proved its use so far.
Yeah, I mean, this is the one that invented the movie of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Oh, yeah. All of these systems are very much subject to what's called hallucinations. They invent things. And you have to be extremely careful about treating their output as at all factual.
Why do they hallucinate? Is it simply that there's a lot of garbage out there in the material, that the information they're drawing?
No, it has to do fundamentally with the way they're set up. They have no internal model of reality, and they have no sense that what they're supposed to produce is true. What they produce is you give them a prompt, and then they produce a word which seems like it's plausible following your prompt, and then another word, and then another word, and so on. So what they're built to generate is text that sounds plausible, that reads like the text in their input training set. They're not built to have any idea of truth. You know, one way of getting plausible sounding text is in fact to generate true text, and so they do sometimes give correct answers, but it's not how they were built. So hallucinations are very much to be expected, and it's not clear that they can be easily got rid of.
That applies
to kind of technology.
That's just not prose or pictures, that's also coding as well. I mean, it sounds like what we're talking about is trying, is it even conceivable within AI and the way it works to have some kind of reality check in there?
I think it's conceivable, but it's not. You have to build your AI so that that's a central focus, and that's not how AIs are being built at the moment. I think they could be built that way. They may well be built that way in the future. That would make them much more useful.
And what about the implications of where this technology is going? There's some scientific philosophers who say, well, machines may replace our species. Do you ever see that happening?
I don't think we want them to. There are a few people who think that that would be a good thing. I think we very much don't want that, and I think we will be wise enough to prevent it. It's easily prevented, it seems to me.
Ernest Davis of New York University there. Joining me now is a philosopher, Susan Schneider, the William F. Dietrich Distinguished Professor at Florida Atlantic University and founding director of the Center for Future Mind. She's the author of Artificial You, AI and the Future of Your Mind. So what exactly is consciousness?
That issue's all over the news right now. As intelligence that's synthetic gets smarter and smarter, people want to know if it's capable of consciousness, and people want to know what the difference is between consciousness and intelligence. So let me just start by saying consciousness is that felt quality of experience. So when you have a strong espresso shot or you stub your toe, any experience you have, it feels like something from the inside to be you. And we know that each of us are conscious, like we can tell when we introspect that we are, and we infer that other humans are conscious because they have the same sort of biology we do. And we also note that non-human animals are conscious beings as well. We know that animals with nervous systems that are like ours are conscious, and even animals that exhibit sophisticated behaviors that are incredibly distinct from us, like the octopus, we believe very strongly that those are conscious beings. So another word for consciousness that comes up a lot right now in these debates about AI is sentience. I'll use that synonymously with the capacity to have conscious experience. That's often a synonym, although there are some technical differences, but I'm not going to go into those. Could an AI be conscious? When we're asking that, we're asking if an AI could have the felt quality of experience. We know that AIs can be very smart, very intelligent at information processing, but not all intelligent systems are conscious. I think we have to really not make the assumption that just because something is capable of, say, chatting intelligently with us, and here I'm thinking of ChatGPT-3, that it also has that felt quality of experience that biological entities have.
I mean, it seemed to me, listening and looking at some of your earlier work, that what you're really saying is consciousness revolves in a sense around pleasure and pain, the ability to evaluate and appreciate experience.
And even broader than just pain and pleasure. So for example, you could be in a somewhat neutral state and just be sitting and you feel, say, the chair pressing on you, or you hear the background noise of an air conditioner in the room. that's kind of a neutral situation, but it's a feeling, a sensory feeling. And then also you could be hearing your own inner thoughts. I mean, there are all kinds of different ways to be conscious. A lot of these are explored in a reference work I did years ago with Max Gelman. It's called The Blackwell Companion to Consciousness. The study of consciousness is really interesting. I mean, it ranges from anesthesiology to anthropology.
What about the big question about life? I mean, what is life? Are any of these AI machines, are any of them alive?
Another fabulous idea. I mean, to contrast consciousness, life, and intelligence. I think this is exactly what we should be doing. So I'm thrilled that you asked. There's no uncontroversial answer to that question. I was the NASA chair with NASA for the last few years. And the definition that NASA used was left deliberately open. It was a self-replicating system that's capable of Darwinian evolution. Now, could AI be a form of life according to that definition? Clearly, yes. I could set up a Darwinian evolution artificial life program that satisfies that definition of life. So the reason that NASA kept it deliberately open is that we haven't discovered life on other planets, and we're not going to make the assumption that all forms of life are like us. So we need to keep it deliberately open. So depending upon your definition, AI may or may not be a form of life. But importantly, something doesn't need to be alive to be conscious in principle. It's conceptually possible that something isn't alive, but still has that felt quality of experience.
And could we make ourselves immortal by, for example, sort of downloading our brains and our life experience into a computer?
I don't think so. If you want to survive death, then if you decide that you're going to have all of your brain states copied into a computer, what you might be doing is make something that acts a lot like you. Suppose the technology is excellent. You might even be making a conscious being, but that would be a conscious AI. You know, we don't know if AI can or can't be conscious. So maybe we could build conscious AI, but I don't think it would still be you. I think you would have died if the process of creating a duplicate destroyed your brain. I think if you want immortality, the best bet would be through biology itself, through nanotechnology, and limited use of microchips in the brain. I think we have to move very carefully in debates about enhancement. And that's actually the point of several chapters of my book, Artificial You.
And you said that the human race, if you like, is facing a change, a wave of change like nothing we've seen before. What do you see as the major points of concern or maybe just interest?
This technology that we're seeing, these large language models, is going to be disruptive. And I think AIs will be capable of doing most human jobs. So I think that's the first thing. And there'll be civil unrest. That's why what we'll need to do is develop tests for machine consciousness and have really sensible discussions, not just gut reactions.
And you've used the phrase Darwinian a number of times. What do you say to those beginning to argue perhaps that the next sort of logic in evolution is that human intelligence ceases to be biological, if you like, and becomes mechanical?
I don't think that's the case for human intelligence, although it will be augmented. But it may be augmented just by something like an intellectual exoskeleton. You put on some brain enhancements at the beginning of your workday and you remove them, for example, or through nanotechnological innovations. It need not be this complete merging of machines the way people like Elon Musk and transhumanists talk about. I actually think that's ill-conceived for a number of reasons.
You suggested that that might be the way that extraterrestrial life forms have evolved.
Yes. So here's the difference. They may have been supplanted altogether by their artificial life forms. And my argument was just based on identifying the most intelligent, advanced aliens. So there'll be plenty of alien civilizations which are biological and which are more intelligent than us. I think AI will, across the board, outsmart us. It will be highly distributed. It won't be just sitting in a basement at MIT. It will be connected to the internet, it will have access to sensory inputs from humans across the globe. Its material will be synthesized very, very quickly, far quicker than the brain is capable, at least in certain ways. I think that an interplanetary intelligence that outthinks us is entirely possible, one that is capable of visiting us through nanoscale means. That's the wave of the future, a sort of artificial intelligence in space that is a swarm intelligence. Here's a quick one for you. So let's go back to the idea of an interplanetary artificial intelligence system. Well, if it takes information at the speed of light 4 years to arrive at Alpha Centauri from Earth, how can you envision a spatiotemporally scattered superintelligent system being conscious? I mean, how would you even have unified conscious experience with a 4-year lag from one place to the next at the speed of light? And, you know, I'm not even sure an advanced alien intelligence could transmit information that quickly.
That was Susan Schneider of the Center for the Future Mind. What is all this going to do to what we read, listen, and watch, to publishing and journalism? Hugo Rifkind and Gabby Wood are experienced journalists and writers based in London. So is AI to be feared or welcomed? What are their hopes?
My chief hope is that it leaves me alone and it doesn't cause any problems either in my life or career, with the focus on the career, I think. But my sort of more positive hopes are that it sort of heralds a new age of scientific breakthrough and sort of sensible public policy, because AI can maybe figure out things better than, for example, Boris Johnson could.
What about you, Gabby?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose mine's a bit more amorphous. I wonder if we'll recognise ourselves in the future, and then I sort of wonder whether that matters or whether we'll learn more about ourselves in the process, because sometimes I think when people are researching AI, they can discover more about what makes us human or how humans work, and that can be very interesting.
And your work, your book is, in England we talk about Ludditeism, but you concentrate particularly on France. I mean, fear of what machines can do to you.
Yes. I only concentrate on France because that's where some of the most interesting machines were built in the 18th century. But there was a lot of travelling around Europe with those machines. And there was, of course, as you say, a lot of fear. The ones that I write about sort of early on, the 18th century machines, I'm calling them machines, they were called philosophical toys. And so I suppose they were presented as ideas in concrete form. So people were supposed to be thinking about them, discussing them. They were presented at court and so on. But, you know, as public exhibitions, they made people faint, they made people cross themselves. You know, people were incredibly worried.
And the danger to people was that it would take their jobs, was that it?
At that point, no. I mean, we're talking about a duck that could poo or a, you know, figure that could play the flute, so that, you know, no danger to their jobs. I think that was a little bit later. I mean, 19th century and certainly in the 20th century, that was the fear.
And by and large, when that fear came, it was mechanical things.
Yes, I think so. I mean, you know, the word robot comes from the word to work. So it comes from the play.
Russian,
well, actually Czech, but yes, exactly, reported. But Karol Čapek, Czech writer's play called Rossum's Universal Robots, that's where the word comes from. And in that play, the robots do take over the factory, or they do take over the world. And so it is to do with, it's connected with work, taking over jobs.
And Hugo, that was mechanical, but the what worries you or what you fear perhaps is now coming into white-collar intellectual territory. I mean, after all, this is called intelligence.
Yes, well, which is actually easier once the systems exist. I think the people who ought to be worried are the people who rely on received wisdom. And we talk about received wisdom as being like as an insult, but actually a lot of us rely on received wisdom. If you're a tax expert, if you're a doctor a lot of the time, if you're a lawyer, if you're an expert in foreign policy, a lot of what you do is process the information you've been given and sort of turn it out in new and interesting ways. And AI is already quite good at that and will presumably soon be excellent at that, which leaves us wondering if there are any gaps that only a human being will be able to fill that it won't be able to.
I mean, it seems to me what I've read about artificial intelligence and the various applications in graphics or in writing that have been come up with, is it's not what I understand as intelligence at all. I mean, it's super sifting of one kind or another.
Yes, although I mean, this is where it gets philosophical, because like I made the point of, you know, we're talking about received wisdom, we're talking about processing stuff that already exists. What AI is not yet very good at, Well, there's two things. One is experiencing, actually having experiences and turning them into new information. And the second is creativity, you know, like making up a story, for example, rather than just repackaging bits of stories that existed before. The question that makes us ask ourselves, though, is whether these are even things, whether there is such a thing as creativity, whether there is such a thing as experience, or whether these things are actually just more advanced level of processing information that already comes in. Just because we don't understand what creativity is, just because we think it's a divine spark that gives you a new idea that's never existed
before. Well, you don't believe in it.
Well, I'd like to believe in it, but it may be that a sufficiently complicated intelligence could do it by maths. And when it does, we might realise that that's what we've been doing all along as well.
I think that's exactly the thing that people were worried about in the 18th century. What is it that we've got that couldn't be replicated? And in fact, you walk straight into Adam and I saying, that's not what I call intelligence. Well, you know, it's because it's almost in anticipatory self-defence, isn't it? You know, that this machine can't possibly copy what I call intelligence. Well, as Hugo says, we don't know.
No, but I mean, whether you're talking about science or the arts, there always has been an element of eureka, of discovery, of something that appears to have come from outside. And you know, a bit disappointing or sort of reductive if you actually say, well, actually, all the answers are already there in the fabric.
Immediately, we're talking about mind and body and whether there's such a thing as a soul. You know, the eureka can just be us doing maths that we don't understand we're doing. You know, us seeing a conclusion that we don't know how we've got to. I mean, if you look at how incredibly good AI has been at playing chess, for example, and how incredibly quick it's being at chess. It's been at learning how to play chess excellently. Now, you can get into a sort of, you can decide, well, the human chess player knows he's playing chess and the AI is just playing chess and doesn't know it. But, I mean, you've got to be basing that on something other than solely your observation of what's happening.
Also, the AI is only playing chess because the human being tells it to.
No, absolutely not. No, I mean, the most successful chess-playing AIs have actually figured out chess from first principles. Originally, I should remember the names of the machines, forgive me that I don't, but originally, precisely what they did with chess-playing AIs was to feed in every chess move that has ever been played, and they were effectively big databases. And they were good. They were good enough to beat people, to beat even the best people, most of the time. But more recently, what they've done with chess-playing AIs, they've just said, here's the thing called chess, these are all the possibilities, go. And the AIs basically run the maths themselves, figure out every possible possibility. And that has made them much, much better at it. So they have been learning, if indeed that is learning.
That's interesting. Yes, Deep Blue in Kasparov, do you remember?
Yeah.
I mean, again, in the 18th century, there was this incredible so-called automaton chess player, very famous, travelled around the world. But there was a man inside. In fact, not always a man. Apparently, there was a woman at one point, and the person had to be scrunched up incredibly small to fit inside the box. But what happened then was it became, amongst chess players, a conversation about who was inside the box. In other words, they could recognise each other by their style of play. And so they started to try and guess who it was and who was beating them. And outside the chess-playing community, people did assume it was a machine and, as I said, got very, very frightened about what that would mean and what the sort of creative spark might be or what the intelligence of a human might contribute. But I think also just to your point about how we discover things, I mean, what about the birth of cinema, which is an observation of something that happens mechanically? In the discovery of that is, oh, this is what this machine can do. I'm going to do this other thing with it. But the fact of it, the fact that it's possible is a, I mean, call it a discovery. As I say, it's just an observation of the truth.
What's important about cinema is the films that have gone afterwards, isn't it? You know, Kubrick and Chabrol and René and all the rest of them. I mean, I can't see a machine doing that or a computer doing that.
Well, I mean, the first example, well, the first well-known example of creativity by algorithm, pretty much, was when Netflix decided to do House of Cards, when they did the Kevin Spacey version of House of Cards, because they basically looked at the stuff that their viewers, they got their machines to look at the stuff that their viewers were watching and what they'd like. And we're like, well, what they really, really like is political dramas starring these kinds of people in these kinds of scenarios. And you can cross-ref that with the people who've watched things like the old House of Cards, and this becomes a prospect. You know, so you can run the numbers on human beings in a way that does give them what they want in a manner that isn't that different from writing a hit.
The machine didn't write the scripts, though, did it?
Well, I mean, it might have done. They were terrible.
All right. Now, you've met or interviewed two leading exponents in AI, Gordat and Lemoine. I mean, how far do they think this is all going?
Only Gordat, actually, I've met, yeah. I think. So Mo Gordat's a fascinating guy because he's a programmer, a coder, but he was also an executive at Google, at the kind of sort of development arm of Google for a long, long time. And he talks about having an epiphany where he came into the office every day and there was a big room full of robot arms who were learning how to pick up balls, just a robot arm trying to pick up a ball. And he said he'd come in every day and he'd look in the room on the way to his office and they were failing to pick up the ball and they were fumbling it. And he was like, this is a joke. We're wasting like millions of dollars on these rubbish arms and they're doing nothing. Then he says one day he looked through the window on his way to his office and one of them had just picked up a ball. And he was like, OK, that's interesting. And then he came back the next day and they all knew how to pick up a ball. And he was like, this is terrifying. At least this is enormous, he said. And he found himself incapable of understanding this in any other way than learning. He said, this is what a child does. A child learns to pick up a ball. And if my external experience of what is happening here is similar to what children do, then we have to learn to treat these creations that we have created in the manner that we treat children. Because otherwise, and this is where it gets interesting and quite frightening, otherwise they will grow up to be vicious. If we treat them as machines and if we treat them as our slaves, then when they become more powerful and intelligent than us, which he believes will happen, that is precisely how they will treat us in the way that we have taught them to treat other people.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Maybe that's a way of teaching us to behave better towards each other, you know, not just towards machines, but to say, to imply that there's a threat. I mean, maybe that's the only way some people will behave well. I was thinking, actually, that sometimes it's to do with grief. I mean, why would you want to replicate human life, really? And Descartes, you know, his daughter died, I can't remember how old she was, but young, and he supposedly built a machine that was a replica of his daughter. Another, this is a work of fiction, but there's a book called The Eve of the Future, in which a man comes to Thomas Edison and says, you know, I would like a woman who is like this. There's a sense of sort of either something missing or something that you're, that you've lost. There is a sense of loss in it, because why would you want to replace it otherwise? Yeah.
What about in your field, the literary field? A lot of talk, particularly given, you know, the new chat app or whatever you want to call it, the writing essays or writing theses or whatever. Are you worried by that?
Not really, no.
Why? I mean, should
I be? I probably should be.
I think you should be.
I should be. Yeah. Well, I don't see why it wouldn't be quite interesting. I mean, for example, you know, there are lots of writers who are interested in formal experiment. Jenny Egan, I remember a little while ago, well, quite a few years ago, wrote a story in tweets because she was interested in Twitter. So lots of people might say, oh, you know, 140 characters is an absolute disaster for the human language, etc. And she said, well, what can you do within these parameters? It's the same as writing a sonnet. I mean, why wouldn't you say, OK, I'll take a framework or give myself a framework and write within that? Actually, it might do something quite interesting with language that we could interact with, or with structure, with storytelling. I don't think there's any harm in putting something through a machine and seeing what comes out, really.
What it forces you to do, we come back to, is it forces you to try and understand what your own spark is, what you're bringing to the project. I mean, like all other journalists, or all other columnists at least, I have tried to write a column using ChatGPT, the chatbot that's available online, just to see what happens. And it is interesting. You tell it to write a column about X.
In your style.
I said write a column in the style of Hugo Rifkind about... I think I was actually writing about AI at the time. Write a column in the style of Hugo Rifkind about AI. And what came out was rubbish. I'd hope more rubbish than me, although I'll leave that for others to judge. But really, it was like, well, you know, if I filed this, then they'd be like, this is nonsense. But then what I told it to do was I said, write a column about AI in the style of Hugo Rifkind. Start with a joke about this. Use these various examples. Use this quote or quote this person in what he said about this and draw an analogy with something else. And then what came out was not super, but it also wasn't terrible. If you'd seen it in a newspaper, you'd have thought, well, that's a not brilliantly written column making some quite interesting points. So you've got to think, actually, what am I bringing to this process? What I'm bringing to this process is the knowledge of what to make this column about and perhaps some literary flair in that I craft hopefully nicer sentences.
And the jokes.
And the the
jokes were better when the machine told them.
My jokes were slightly better, but the AI's jokes were worrying. I mean, they had all the structure. You know, they were as good as a politician's jokes any day.
Hugo Rifkind of The Times and Gabby Wood of the Booker Prize there, ending this edition of Worldview. Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas is funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The Worldview series is produced by Mari Jessel and Eve Webster, and the sound engineer is Gareth Jones. I'm Adam Bolton, and it's really me, not an AI chatbot. Until next time, thanks for listening.